I didn't know that all you had to do was announce that you're running for president in order to get a basically community standard immune Instagram account. I think this is a big plus, big news. Do you have to even be eligible, or is it can just anyone announce that they're running?
Well, I think you should test that, Evelyn. I think you should test that. It is a long shot that as an Australian, you'd be allowed to become president of the United States, but that you yourself are now running for president and therefore should be verified, should have free ad access. I think you should get lots of lift and be recommended. Let's get you on the debate stage.
Sounds good. Welcome to Moderated Content's weekly, slightly random and not at all comprehensive news update from the world of trust and safety with myself, Evelyn Doeck, and Alex Stamos. Today is a big day, Alex, because I read this morning, it is the first day for Linda Yaccarino, Twitter's new CEO. So congratulations, Linda. Welcome aboard.
Linda, this hit is going out to you.
It's the sound you want to hear as you come through the door. And what a day to be your first day as CEO. A bunch of stuff here that you would really, really want walking in the door. So where we're going to start is with a story that you feature in prominently, Alex. This is for all the right reasons this time. So this is a story about a study that you've done with the Stanford Internet Observatory, co-authored with David Thiel and Renee DiResta, about a network of accounts advertising self-generated sexual abuse material and findings that you found in the course of doing that report about Twitter. Do you want to tell us what you found?
Yeah. So this is a big investigation into a phenomena that is really creating a lot of CSAM. We will be releasing that report on Wednesday. There'll be some more media coverage. And so I don't want to preview that too much. And just to be clear, we looked at lots of platforms and one of our big area of focus is the fact that this is a cross-platform issue. And because it's a cross-platform issue, you have lots of problems that are very difficult for one platform to solve on their own, although we have already seen a bunch of fixes put in place since we notified companies. Anyway, we can talk about that more next week, and hopefully we can have David and Renee on, my fantastic co-authors on this. But one of the interesting things that we found while doing this work is that, a while ago, David is our chief technologist at SIO. We worked together on a variety of issues, including child safety at Facebook, and he built a scanner so that all of the content that SIO is pulling in from a bunch of different places, if an image comes in, we now have a scanner that checks to see whether it is known child sexual abuse material. And we did that because, one, we're doing child safety investigations, but also just because if you're looking at a bunch of different platforms, especially kind of these alt platforms, the ones that don't have trust and safety teams, the ones that aren't doing anything, even if you're looking at like a political topic, you might run into CSAM. And when Stanford fires me, I want it to be for some kind of cool academic freedom issue. I don't want it to be because some 19-year-old ran into a picture of a child being abused because they're looking at a hashtag and some real jerk, polluted that hashtag with real CSAM, right? So we scan everything as it comes in. And if we get a hit on this detection, this is the exact same scanning that the big platforms do. We use the exact same code. We automatically notify NCMEC and the metadata gets encrypted and put in a place that only David and I could possibly get to it. Students are never exposed. And we send to NCMEC so it can be handled by law enforcement. So while we are not, I think, required to do this under 2258A, which is the law that affects electronic communication service providers, we hold ourselves to that standard. So while we're doing this investigation, which includes looking at stuff on Twitter, what we start to see is a bunch of hits in our system where CSAM is being discovered. And this ranged from the somewhat more mild stuff with teenagers to the absolute worst, what you call A1, which is the worst stuff that involves little kids, and it's really, really bad. We're not going to talk about the details of what that means. And this is known stuff. And so, content that has been seen, that has been hashed, that is coming out of the hash banks of NCMEC or the Tech Coalition or one of the different groups for the hashes that we subscribe to, that we're getting hits on, this was just super basic. And it demonstrated a real kind of regression at Twitter, that clearly something broke there, because Twitter has been part of the Tech Coalition, which is the group that works on child safety between tech companies, I think since pretty much its beginning. They've done a lot of work in this space, but it looks like a ton of those folks have been fired and there's only a handful left and basic systems are breaking. And so, you know, I don't think this is not, was not intentional on Twitter's part, but when you fire all your engineers and you fire your investigators who do this work, then you're going to end up having this breakages. And that's what we found. So we tried to notify Twitter. We didn't hear back. We notified NCMEC, of course. We eventually got a contact at Twitter and we were able to brief the handful of people who still work there on child safety. And after a while, they were able to fix it. But I can't guarantee to you that's still fixed because unfortunately, the other thing that happened last week is that Twitter cut off our access as they are going through and cutting off all academic groups who do any cooperation. And so we have gone from working side by side with them on Chinese interference, you know, China lying about COVID, about Russian infiltration into sub-Saharan Africa, on child safety issues, on suicide, on self-harm. We've done all this work with Twitter side by side, try to help them make the platform better and for them to help us with our research. And now they have officially cut us off and lots of other academic institutions. So this is kind of the last hurrah of something that we're going to be able to fix, at least for the foreseeable future, or until, say, the Digital Services Act brings back this access, which is not clear if that's going to happen yet.
Right. And to just to underline it here, like this is the really the bare minimum that you can do around child safety.
Yeah.
As a tech platform. Like this is, you know, Musk comes in, says this is his highest priority, that child abuse is like the one thing that he really is going to get behind in cleaning up the platform. And this is not complicated stuff that you were noticing was breaking. This was like the basic first level of protection, right?
Right. This is the bare minimum. This is known stuff for which you're given a hash and they were allowing it to be posted publicly. Right. So we don't have any access to private data. This is all public stuff on Twitter. We just had the ability to use certain search terms. Now, we found dozens and dozens of hits, but that was only for specific search terms. So there might have been hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of examples of this being posted across the platform. And so, yes, this is just the basic stuff and they're failing the basic stuff, which once again demonstrates that I think a lot of his child safety alignment is not a real alignment. That is part of him signaling to QAnon and the super right wing crowd who have kind of adopted child safety as a theme, even though they've done no actual work in that space. And we have yet to hear from the quote-unquote child safety experts who have been big Musk backers, who have no actual history in this space, who I've never seen at the Crimes Against Children conference, who I've never seen at a tech coalition conference, who I've never seen write a paper on child safety or testify in a trial. You know, all the things that my colleagues and I have done. None of them have commented so far on the fact that you know, Twitter has just basically failed in this. And you know, so I feel bad. Like there's a handful of good people who are still trying to keep the lights on at Twitter, but it's clearly becoming harder and harder as they lose their resources to be able to fix this kind of stuff.
So there's good coverage of this in the Wall Street Journal, which we'll link to in the show notes. And it's exactly what you'd want on your first day as CEO of a new company. A big headline in the Wall Street Journal showing how you were. There are basic systems failing within your company to protect against the most basic forms and horrific forms of child sexual abuse.
Linda, if you're listening, Linda, go find those people, like the handful of people who work in child safety still, and go meet with them and ask them what they need to make sure this doesn't happen again. And maybe ask them, do they think it's smart to cut off the research groups that they've cooperated with in the past who have helped them with these issues? Or would you rather find out when the FBI comes knocking? That's your other option.
Right. Another headline that greeted Linda as she walked in the door today is a great headline in the New York Times about how Twitter's ad sales are plummeting. So they're down 59% from the year before. I'm sure totally unrelated to the other headline that we were just discussing, how advertisers feel about being on the platform. A nice little tidbit in this story in the New York Times was that, you know, one of the things that they're promoting at Twitter to try and woo advertisers back is tools called adjacency controls, where these are basically brand safety tools to keep ads away from tweets containing specific words. And the New York Times had reporting that some advertisers are using these tools to keep their content away from Mr. Musk's tweets in particular. So that's exactly what you want when the face of your company is what advertisers are trying to avoid on your platform. Another thing that would have greeted Linda as she walked through the door today was a letter from four senators asking if Twitter still had enough people to run their company in legally compliant ways. So Senators Warren, Wyden, Markey, and Hirono wrote to ask if Twitter was still able to comply with the terms of its FTC consent decree and the privacy and data security obligations that it has under that. And they were citing two recent high-profile trust and safety resignations as the reason why they're concerned, which, fair enough, because in the last week, Twitter has lost its head of trust and and Safety, Ella Owen, and its head of brand safety and advertising quality, AJ Brown, two significant departures. And when you've lost Ella Owen, Alex, I don't even know what to say. I don't know what to make of this story. So what do you think?
Well, so it looks like a lot of this comes out of a really kind of bizarre thing that happened last week, which is blow up about this film called What is a Woman? As any of our listeners will know, part of the recent culture wars, a lot of it has been about trans issues, and kind of a right-wing provocateur has made a movie that he thinks is a lot better made and funnier than it clearly is, called What is a Woman? Now, I've watched it. It's insulting. It's like, it's kind of out of place. It's stupid. It's got some not so great stuff in it, but it's also like what you kind of expect in a big pluralistic democracy of people arguing back and forth, of people having stupid movies and stuff. But there's this like weird back and forth where Twitter apparently promised them like a high billing, like a special deal to distribute this movie on Twitter. And then they revoked that and then lowered its distribution. This became a huge cause celeb on the right wing. Elon initially backed the decision to not super promote this film, even though it was on, but like it was harder to find and Discovery wasn't, and certainly didn't get like top billing. And then he reversed himself. And so I think whatever you think of the substance of the decisions around this film, it's pretty clear that Irwin ran into the exact same problem that Yoel Roth did, which is that whatever decision Musk makes, he does not feel bound to it if he gets enough criticism, at least from the right. He never does anything because something comes to the left, but he's not going to let anybody be to the right of him. And if he gets enough criticism, he will reverse himself. And it's just impossible to run a trust and safety team if, you know, whatever decision the CEO makes, they're willing to reverse because they got enough tweets at them from Cat Turd or whomever, right? And so I'm not totally sure exactly why she quit, but it does seem that either he asked her to leave or she decided to leave because of a disagreement over this, that, you know, they've had a bunch of anti-trans stuff. She has personally approved that. So I don't think she was like standing up on principle here, but maybe she found of like, hey, you can't change your mind between 9 a.m. and 10 a.m. and then blame me for it, for enforcing your rules. And then you getting angry that I was enforcing the rules that you signed off on. So like, good luck, Linda, for this being, he's not the CEO anymore, but he's going to be the chairman. And I think he said he's the CTO. So clearly he's going to be involved in all of these content moderation decisions. And whatever you think the appropriate decision is, sometimes you just have to make one and stick with it. And if you're going to have a situation where the CEO decides like they're going to wiffle waffle back and forth, yeah, that's not going to do anything. I think overall, the overall controversy ended up with the movie being seen way more than otherwise, right? So this has turned into kind of a Hunter Biden situation where we will hear complaints, howls of complaints about the several hours during which this thing was downranked. And yet it probably got 10 times the viewership because of the Streisand effect here, because a lot of people were being pushed to it. Which again, like, you know, people can have their own opinion on the movie, whatever you think of it, though. I do think it's the kind of thing that we should expect to exist and we should allow to exist. But it's also appropriate for Twitter to say, we're not going to give this thing top billing, right? Like, we're not going to allow this thing to be massively promoted because we disagree with its contents, even if we don't completely take it down. That kind of destruction of reach while allowing the underlying speech, as Elon has said, ripping off our colleague Renee, I think is an appropriate decision. It's too bad that Musk doesn't have the ability to stick to anything that he decides.
Right. I mean, this controversy was totally predictable. The policy that the video was supposed to be violating, or was said to be violating, was that it misgendered people, I think, twice in the movie. Twitter used to have an explicit protection against misgendering in its hateful conduct policy. It got rid of it about a month ago. We talked about it. And Ella Owen, in fact, came on the record and say, no, we've got rid of the wording, but the policy still applies. Obviously, that was probably an untenable position because the wording went missing for some reason, and the reason became apparent in the last week. It does seem a strange hill to die on, given all of the things that have happened over the last 6 months that Ella Owen has been in charge of trust and safety. But still, I guess, you know, it's an untenable position to be in when you're at the face of making all of these decisions and you're the person standing behind you is constantly changing their mind, and you're the one that's having to try and make that look rational and like it's a policy-based decision. So yes, good luck, Linda. That's your job now, I guess.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck, Linda. Brand safety. And on the FTC side, like you mentioned the FTC thing, they've lost Ella. They lost their head of brand safety this week. And this follows their chief security officer, chief compliance officer, chief privacy officer all quitting, none of whom I believe have been replaced. So I'm not exactly sure who's there anymore making anything. Certainly nobody is going to be taking like a head of role where they could be pushed forward by Musk of being the front person for these decisions. You know, I think for the people who are there, they're all kind of keeping their heads down and allowing him to be the face of whatever Twitter decides to do.
Right. And I mean, you know, the one thing that everyone always talks about, like with these difficult decisions is transparency. And it's the one thing, again, that Musk has said he's really behind and really thinks is important. We don't know who's there. We don't know who's working on these decisions. We don't know who's responsible for these decisions, except, of course, Musk. We now don't really know what the policy is. It seems to be changing on the whim. And you mentioned them cutting off API access. Alex, it's even worse than you suggested. It's not only that academic researchers such as yourself can't track what's going on the platform on an ongoing basis. And so, for example, these systems breaking around child sexual abuse, you won't be able to research that going forward in the future. In quite an extraordinary demand, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this, Twitter is sending letters to researchers that have acquired data through that API over the course of their research in the past and demanding that they delete all of that data within 30 days unless they pay the new rate of access to the API, which is the ridiculous $42,000 a month, you know, completely beyond the capacity of academic researchers. And so all of these academic researchers are in this place where they're being told to delete the data upon which years of research is being based. And, you know, the only rationale is like some, fear of transparency that I can think of. I mean, I can't even really understand what's going on here.
Right. Talking about Streisand effect, right? Like nothing says we have confidence in our decisions. Like I am going to threaten to sue academics because they have data that they collected, public data. So we've got to remember, this is not private data. This is nothing secret. This is not a Cambridge Analytica situation where anybody abused APIs to get access to data that was not meant to be public. This is public data that people have effectively used APIs to scrape, with Twitter's permission, a huge amount of the public discussion. So if we're going to have a public discussion, there are people who are going to study it for a variety of reasons. There's people who study, you know, how do people interact with each other? There's people who study how do teenagers talk about things? There's people that study suicide and self-harm. And, you know, and when people have mental health issues, how do they interact online? All of this research requires being able to see all this public discussion and be able to analyze it. There are a variety of different ethical frameworks around how you protect the privacy of individuals. And I think any good academic researcher will be very careful to use the data in aggregate without pointing out individual people and the speech, even public speech of individuals. But there's not like a legitimate privacy argument here. There's not a legitimate like transparency argument. This is just straight up, we want money. If we don't have the money, then you're not going to be allowed to criticize us. We're not going to, which is exactly what you and I talked about, that this was, I think, the likely as well as one of the badder scenarios for Twitter was them continuing to be the centerpiece of, now it is very, you know, Twitter used to be a centerpiece of all political discussion in the United States. And now lots of people on the left and more of the Democratic and moderate side have left. And now it's become more of a hard right platform, but it is becoming the most important hard right platform. It is definitely passing up Truth and Getter and Rumble and other platforms to like among people in that space of the place where they gather. And so the idea that you can have these big public discussions that have real effects on our politics that perhaps are being manipulated by outside forces, and nobody's allowed to talk about that and look at it and say, this is what I see going on, is just completely ridiculous and not compatible with any of the free speech ideals that Musk himself has talked about. So it is becoming a dark day. None of these things are going to stop, like the people who are scraping for ad purposes or to violate people's privacy, or the defense contractors who sell stuff to the DOD. They don't care. It's only going to be like legitimate researchers who have to go through IRBs, who have to get approval on their privacy and such, who are going to care about legal threats. And you talk about the 40,000. Realistically, the tier at which you have to be at if you're doing any of this research is like the $200,000 a month tier, which is obviously just completely out of bounds for any academic research group.
Right. And you mentioned the Digital Services Act as a potential tool that might force Twitter to keep its data more open to researchers, and that's sort of yet to see what's going to come of that. There is certainly going to be some sort of a showdown between Twitter and DSA compliance. In the past sort of week or so, it pulled out of the European Union Code of Practice on Disinformation, which isn't a surprise given that it had laid off a bunch of its Brussels trust and safety workers and also hadn't been filing its compulsory transparency reports under that code. The code was a weird thing. you know, I sort of have a bunch of hesitations about the code anyway. It was a notionally voluntary piece of commitment by the industry to comply with these obligations that, you know, had serious sort of free speech implications, given that they're around a code of practice on disinformation. I don't really need to necessarily spell that out. But August 25, a bunch of legal obligations come into force under the Digital Services Act, and compliance isn't going to be voluntary under that. And, you know, the fact that Twitter is pulling out of these obligations suggests that compliance is going to be messy. And, you know, Thierry Breton, the EU commissioner responsible, or what he's calling himself, is, you know, the chief enforcer of this law. He said in response to Musk, you know, you can run, but you can't hide. And they're going to be doing stress tests of all of these, of Twitter's ability to comply in the next few months as well. And so again, if you're walking through the door as Twitter's new CEO, you've got these stress tests coming up in a month and you've just lost your two top trust and safety officials. That is not necessarily the position that I would want to be in. So as the title of this episode will be now, good luck, Linda, I think is where we're at.
Yeah. Viacom deals.
Okay, so to give Linda a break, let's look at some mayhem on some of the other platforms that's happening at the moment. So YouTube this week announced that it will stop enforcing its 2020 election misinformation policy and will stop removing content that advances false claims that widespread fraud, errors, or glitches occurred in the 2020 and other past US elections. A good thing there's no big events coming up in the next year or so where the amount and importance of such claims is likely to dramatically increase. And I hope if you're at all nervous, don't worry. YouTube said that it carefully deliberated this change, although it didn't provide any further examples of what factors it considered at all in weighing this decision. I don't really know what to say. I think there's important conversations to have about policies once they get put in place and continually reviewing them and making sure that they're still current. And also, you know, making sure that resources are being put towards actually policing the most damaging and important claims. And problems on services. But this is just a weird change to make at a particularly weird time. And I don't know what would have been sort of driving YouTube's decision here.
Yeah, I mean, there's no justification of it. It's not relevant anymore, right? This is a situation like, no, yeah, you know, as of 2023, there's no elections on the time horizon where it's almost guaranteed that people will say it was stolen and then tried to spread that via YouTube. Unfortunate call. I don't know what to say other than this is not great timing, and it is going to once again make YouTube the real centerpiece of this kind of abusive action. They're basically saying, you know, we want to be the number one video platform here. You know, as much as you wanted to get Susan up on the hill, it does seem with their leadership change that perhaps they're going to be backing off. It also, I think, demonstrates that it has been effective. There has been an attempt to frame any policies around whether the election disinformation, where it is like factually untrue claims about the election. A number of platforms had those policies because they saw those policies in 2020 as being nonpartisan, that it was completely appropriate for you to say you can't lie about who you are. You can't lie about the actual functioning of the election, like where the voting is, when the voting is, all that kind of stuff. And you can't make claims that are factually untrue about the outcome of the election. That was not seen as a partisan thing. And in the last several years, what's happened is that has been turned into a partisan thing because you still have a significant portion of, you know, to be frank, the Republican Party that believes the election was stolen. This is going to become a bipartisan thing. I'm just going to put a Yeah, like when we were doing our election work in 2022, one of our expectations was that Republicans were going to do much better, and you would end up with probably like House members who lost all of a sudden coming up with excuses that the loss was driven by some kind of manipulation of the vote. It's, you know, there is continues to be a subgroup of leftists and Democrats who believe that the 2020 election that Joe Biden legitimately won, but a bunch of Republican victories were actually fake and were due to a really specific kind of rigging of the election. And they believe this with all their heart. So, I mean, for them to do it because they feel like it's a partisan side, I think obviously it's a mistake on many levels, but it's also a mistake to say that this is only going to be a one-sided thing. If we normalize as a country that the losers get to fight for years saying that the election was stolen from them, then that is going to be a really bad outcome, and every loser is going to do it because there's not enough pushback on the Democratic side that if you're a loser in the Democratic Party, that you're not going to try to maintain your you know, one, you have a lot of ego, but also people build these supporter networks that they don't want to give up. And one of the ways to keep that network of supporters behind you is to make them feel aggrieved, like things were stolen from you. And we had a little bit of that in the 2020 primaries with Bernie Sanders people saying the whole thing was rigged by the DNC and stuff. We have some history of Russia actually leaning into that and the Russians supporting Bernie's claims. And so it's quite possible that in the 2024 cycle that this will become more of a bipartisan thing. And then YouTube's going to look back and say, oh, great, now we're hosting all this content from a bunch of different people from a bunch of different political parties saying that they've been that the election's been stolen through all these
things. And I mean, this election is just looking to be an absolute mess across basically all of the platforms. So over to Instagram, which on Sunday lifted its suspension against the account of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an outspoken anti-vaccine activist, is how the Washington Post complimentarily nicely described him. Yes.
Wow. Outspoken. That's
so outspoken, in fact, that Kennedy, RFK, lost his account in 2021 for repeatedly sharing debunked claims about COVID and vaccines. But he announced he is running for president as a long shot Democratic challenger to Biden over the. And so Instagram has reinstated his account and all 700,000 plus followers, which, I mean, I didn't know that all you had to do was announce that you're running for president in order to get a basically community standard immune Instagram account. I think this is a big plus, big news. Do you have to even be eligible, or is it, can just anyone announce that they're running?
Well, I think you should test that, Evelyn. I think you should test that. It is a long shot that as an Australian, you'd be allowed to become president of the United States, but that you yourself are now running for president and therefore should be verified, should have free ad access. I think you should get lots of lift and be recommended. Let's get ready to get you on the debate stage.
Sounds good. I mean, just let's see what outrageous things I can post before they finally kick me off. I mean, I think this is it's an amazing decision. We've always known that.
I would say the odds of the Constitution being amended to allow you to be president is about the same odds as RFK Jr. becoming president. Yes. Right? Like, you're not talking about that far off, that many, you know, decimal points of percentage.
I don't know if you saw, though, he got the much sought after and very valuable Jack Dorsey endorsement over the weekend. So I mean, that's something I don't have in my back pocket. He does have that on me,
and effectively an Elon, you know, endorsement through this Twitter space.
Right, exactly. Because not to be outdone on outrageousness. Yes, Instagram reinstated RFK's account, but Musk, by the time you listen to this this moderated content episode, will have hosted a Twitter Spaces with RFK Jr. because he just wanted to make sure. I mean, he thought Linda's first day on the job was too boring and not enough going on, and so why not also host this Twitter Spaces where I'm sure nothing at all problematic will be said.
So on this policy, I mean, you and I talked about this before. There's a legitimate problem here for platforms. Is like, you don't want to get involved in a political race, right? Like, in a democracy, you do not want to be the ones deciding what speech is appropriate from people who are legitimately running. But the problem is that we're so early in the cycle, there's no such thing as a official measurement here. Even the parties themselves and the different committees that put together the debates and stuff have to come up with kind of these weird artificial standards. Like, you have X donors, you have Y people who support you in different states and such, but we're too early for even that. So effectively, anybody who has enough Twitter followers and says they're running for president gets to be call themselves that. And I don't understand how Instagram is making this determination. I think it's nuts. I think it's nuts because effectively they're saying they're going to highly motivate grifters to. I mean, there's already plenty of grifters who run for president without knowing that they're not going to win. But now there's a whole nother motivation, which is that you get out of Instagram jail as long as you just declare. So you get to both raise money for your super PAC, become a kingmaker, get free TV, and get Instagram to unban you. It's a pretty good
deal. Right. And it also just highlights how little we got out of the 3-year long process with the Meta Oversight Board around Donald Trump's account, where, you know, Meta suspended it. It went to the Oversight Board. They gave back the decision with barely any guidelines of how Meta should be making these decisions. And then Meta reinstated Trump's account. We talked about it on this podcast with barely any guidelines of how they had made their decision to reinstate the account and how they were going to be, you know, making these decisions going forward. We went through all of that process, and here we are still with these completely opaque decisions made without sort of any explanation or understanding of, you know, where's the line? How are they deciding when a candidate goes over the line? You know, when they reinstated Trump's account, they made all of of these comments about how they were instituting guardrails on the account to make sure to sort of contain the damage that might happen from harmful content that, you know, a known repeat offender might post. And there's sort of not been no comment whether RFK Jr. is going to have any of those restrictions applied to his account either. So, you know, we went through all of that process, all of that money set up and attention paid to this oversight board process. And here we are, and we're still sort of none the wiser about how this decision making took place. Okay, over to TikTok. There's been, in the last couple of weeks, there's been a few stories, Alex, that you've been quoted on around sort of more evidence of poor data security practices and sharing user data on internal messaging tools and things like that. So tell us what's been going on and what it means.
Yeah, so there's been stories that the data for individual users keeps on getting copy and pasted into kind of the internal discussion forums that are used inside of TikTok. This is a common problem for tech companies. We have this problem all the time at Facebook and all kinds of rules about, you know, personal information cannot be shared on these discussion forums, can't be put into documents, can't be put in chat and such. Part of the problem this creates for companies is, you know, for GDPR and a bunch of different privacy regimes, you need to effectively know where your PII is, so you can track it, you can secure it. If somebody requests for it to be deleted, you can delete it. And if people are just copy and pasting it into effectively Word docs or Google docs or, you know, chat forums all over the place, you lose track of it. So it's not shocking that this problem exists. It is a common problem. The more shocking part is this discussion forum is hosted by ByteDance in China, right? And so kind of the overall, like, there's a little issue here about the actual data, but the overall thrust and the lesson we can learn from this is that TikTok is a thin layer on top of ByteDance. Like, most of TikTok's operations, their engineering, their operations, their technical operations, a ton of their work is done by ByteDance, and TikTok is a brand with its own employees, but that a ton of this stuff is ByteDance on the back end. And no matter how much TikTok keeps on repeating Project Texas, that has not changed yet, right? And so we're ending up in this situation where, you know, the kind of the period of time during which TikTok is making promises around the security of PII against employees in China versus the actual implementation is a huge risk to them, because they have overpromised and they have underdelivered so far on, you know, they do say, hey, we're still working on this, but how long are you going to say we're still working on this after you've had your CEO go and promise Congress that's going to get fixed? He was extremely careful in his language, but certainly, you know, the overall thrust of his testimony and all the other things TikTok says is not, hey, most of our stuff is still ByteDance, right? That is not the, they're like, oh, what they're trying to make people believe is there's tiny little things that are still kind of connected to China. And the truth is that a huge chunk of the company is still running on Chinese infrastructure. And therefore, if you're worried about the People's Liberation Army and the Ministry of State Security, as we should be, then the security of that data from those kinds of actors is not guaranteed at all.
Okay, and the last story that we should talk about, because it's happened in the past few weeks and it was one of the biggest stories around social media, was the release of the Surgeon General's advisory on social media and youth mental health. Now, our audience will certainly have heard all about this by now, so we don't need to sort of recap the report or its findings. You know, they would have seen all of the headlines in the media that the Surgeon General warned of a profound risk of harm to mental health. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this one, Alex, particularly, you know, as someone that's worked in these social media companies, but also as a father of teenage kids, how you think about this?
Yeah, so I mean, I agree that I think social media has been really bad for teenage mental health. There are upsides, but I think the downsides probably outweigh the upsides from what I have personally seen. Now, this is much less of my area of expertise. We just held a couple months ago an event on child safety at Stanford, in which we tried to bring together people from the different areas. And it turns out there's two kind of totally different universes of people working on child health and child safety online. There's the pediatricians and psychologists and such who study, like, what is the effect of this on kids' brains and how kids interact with each other. A lot of this has to do with, like, the kind of the bad stuff that you and I dealt with as teenagers is just amplified if you're doing it on chat all night until 1 a.m., right? Of, like, you know, people have been bullied and girls have had, you know, body image issues for a long period of time, but all this stuff gets really amplified by the internet. And then there's the adversarial part in which adults are actually doing bad things. And so I've worked much more on the adversarial part. That's like our Twitter report, and our work this week is all about the adversarial side. And it's fascinating to get these folks together because they know very little about each other's worlds. And I learned all these things from, we had these pediatricians from Stanford Hospital, from, you know, Lucille Packard Children's Hospital. We had folks in the med school from the psychology department. It was just fascinating to hear about the kinds of things Surgeon General is talking about here, which is like, there's real good peer-reviewed evidence that like social media overall is bad for teenagers. And I certainly see that with my kids. Again, it's the social things. I don't think the social media, it's not like zapping their brains directly, but the way kids interact with each other and kind of the heightening of drama, the fact that like something can go effectively viral very, very quickly, much faster than it could when, you know, you and I were taking the phone down the hallway. I don't know. Did you have like the huge cord that you could take the family phone into your room? Like I bought one.
We were up to wireless phones by the time I was using them.
You're younger.
But yes.
Yes. Right. And so for me, it was like, I literally went to Radio Shack and I bought like a 40-foot RJ11 cord. So like you could get it all the way to my room. And so, you know, back in those days, like the speed at which kids could be crap to each other or could push each other or bully each other or talk about these kinds of things is much reduced than what's going on right now. And then obviously kids are being exposed to this huge universe of all of this content, some of which again is good and some of it, which is not so good. A lot of it, which is not so good. And so I totally agree with like the overall thrust here. The problem is like the practical implications are really tough. And what we keep on seeing is proposals for child safety bills that are either one, completely destroy the privacy of everybody, not just children, because you have things like everybody has to show a government ID to use the internet, right? So it's like, that's how the People's Republic of China solves this problem. It's like, you just have to show ID and you're able to get a SIM card and to get like a login, but like not really compatible with how Western democracies try to do things. Or you have laws that are kind of like FOSTA and SESTA, in which you create all these new liabilities. And there's a really good piece in Tech Dirt that I think we should link to, where he talks about how one of these proposed laws, you already have like the Heritage Foundation and some other right-wing groups basically saying, oh yes, we're going to use, if these laws passed, we'll use them to wipe out any kind of pro-LGBT content online. And so like you can agree with what the Surgeon General is saying as a general issue, but the proposals we hear both out of Surgeon General's office and especially out of Congress, I think are always kind of short-sighted and never consider the second and third order effects of how those things will be abused by bad actors.
Yeah, I really appreciate that because I've been super frustrated by this conversation, which like everything seems to have devolved into two camps. One which says social media is the worst thing in the world that's, you know, straight into our kids' brains and corrupting them and, you know, it's a dangerous, toxic substance and we need to ban it entirely. And another is like, no, it's really good. It's connecting LGBT youth all around the country, which is also good, and really not ignoring the real risks that do exist. And I think you're right. Like we need to find a way to be conscious and, you know, attentive to these risks without sort of jumping to these pretty draconian responses. I'm worried about this, and I'm certainly not envious of parents that have to wrestle with these issues. But, you know, a lot of the policy responses that come out, including in the Surgeon General's report, are pretty worrying. You know, the Surgeon General reports to like points to a sort of strong history of taking a safety first response to things like toys, cars, and medication. And there's a big difference between toys, cars, and medication and a social media platform. You don't need to be a First Amendment professor to know that, like, you know, there's no constitutional right to play with toys, and there is a constitutional right to speak and to listen. And that's not merely an academic point. This is not just a point about what some old dudes wrote down hundreds of years ago. That's because we protect freedom of speech because of its value, but also because we really worry about what happens when we call on the government to adjudicate what is quote unquote harmful speech. And if you are asking the government to, you know, judge what is harmful to children, yes, absolutely. You're going to see governments that find pro-LGBT content, you know, content about birth control, all sorts of things. You don't need to sort of use your imagination very hard to work out where that leads. And it's a pretty dark and scary place. And so we need to find a way to find a response to these risks that doesn't result in that kind of response.
Yeah, I think the other issue here is we're not talking to teenagers. Like, if you talk to teenagers about this, they will say, yeah, you know, sometimes using Instagram, I feel really sad, but also I can connect up to my friends and these are the positive things. And I don't think we listen enough, especially the older teenagers who have, I think, the ability to have some self-awareness here of to what are the parts of social media and online environments that are negative versus positive, and what are the situations which are positive? The real problem part of this is we've never really had like a good push from a research perspective and design perspective about designing surfaces for teenagers that are specifically good for facilitating positive interactions between young people, right? Like, it's just never been a real design goal of any of these products. And I don't know how you encourage that without creating kind of this crazy nebulous legal liability that then could be abused by all these bad actors for anything they see that they don't think is quote unquote kid safe, and therefore try to repress it, not just from kids, but from any adult who uses the internet.
Well, any parting words for Linda this week, Alex, as we wrap up?
Well, I'm going to be honest. Linda, if you want to chat, we would love to talk. It's my last name at stanford.edu. Happy to talk about the work that the fantastic work Twitter did around the early days of child safety and building things like the Tech Coalition. We'd love to talk to you about how Twitter was a leader in trying to get rid of fake accounts and bots and networks of folks who are trying to manipulate the platform, and how perhaps there's been a little bit of backsliding in those areas. So if you want a little bit of the history of how this stuff can actually work out well, I'd be happy to give that to you, because it's going to be the faster that Twitter understands that these are areas that are pretty critical, like having a platform that's completely overrun by the 50 Cent Army of the People's Republic of China, just flooding it with pro-Chinese messages every time you say something that's critical of China. Like, we just had the anniversary of Tiananmen Square this weekend. You should go look. People should go look at any discussion involving the anniversary of Tiananmen Square is flooded with pro-Chinese messages in a way that was not true any other June 4th in the last 10 years. And that is a direct response to the Twitter getting rid of the teams that go and find that and shut down this kind of organized manipulation. So my email's open, Linda. DM's open. Drop me a line and we'll talk about brand safety.
I'd be a little surprised, to be honest, if on her first day she found 40-something minutes to listen to this podcast, or maybe only 15, given that you can listen to it on 2 to 3 times speed. But, you know, it wouldn't actually be the worst thing that she could do today to learn a bit about the platform that she is now at the helm of. And so with that, this has been your Moderated Content Weekly Update. This show is available in all the usual places, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and show notes are available at law.stanford.edu/moderated-content. This episode wouldn't be possible without the research and editorial assistance of John Perino, policy analyst at the Stanford Internet Observatory, and is produced by the wonderful Brian Pelletier. Special thanks also to Justin Fu and Rob Huff.